If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Hello and welcome to the Born in Japan podcast, probably the best way of learning about life in Japan without actually being in Japan. I'm your host, Chris Broad, and this week there is no Pete Donaldson. He's gone. I fired him. No, he's not fired. He has just taken a week off. I've given him a break because I thought it was time to interview someone new, someone different. We do quite a lot of podcasts now on the Born in Japan podcast, twice weekly, and I figured it'd be nice to actually introduce more people and have some interviews like we did with Sharla last month. So Pete's got the week off, and this week I'd like to introduce you to Tokyo Lens, my good friend Norm. He is a YouTuber with 150,000 subscribers. He focuses mainly on travelling Japan, short form documentaries and photography. You might have seen him recently on Journey Across Japan. He joined us on the third episode, the whole series, but he appeared in the third episode as the disgruntled guy walking into a shop who was surprised by the presence of Dr. Jelly in the commercial. He's had a good year, 3 viral hit videos, which we'll discover later on in this episode. He's got a podcast. He's a master of the shamisen, having played with my arch rivals, the Yoshida brothers. He speaks Japanese at a native level. He's called Japan home for over a decade. And here he is. Norm, how are you doing?
I am doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
I bigged you up there quite a lot.
Yeah, it was about 30% accurate.
So for those of you that don't know you, what do you believe in, Norm?
What do I believe in?
Who are you? Give us a quick intro.
All right, well, I think your intro was pretty clear. Pretty much everything started around the shamisen side of things, actually. Been in Japan for a bit over a decade. Decided to dedicate myself to becoming the apprentice of the Yoshida brothers. And kind of built a life around shamisen and was encouraged to start a YouTube channel to share the background of that. And then it turned into what it is today. That's all of it.
So I think what's interesting about Norm is he has lived in Japan a long time, but he's really immersed himself in every aspect of the culture. Like, you've done so much stuff. We just go through that list. It's quite impressive. A lot of foreigners I meet here never really seem to integrate into Japan. They've got like one leg in, one leg out, and you never know if they're going to be around that long. But you've been here over 10 years and you've done so much stuff. I'm looking forward to diving a bit deeper into that over this podcast and the next one on Sunday. But first things first, how and when did we meet? We've known each other about 2 years now, right?
At least. I remember there was coffee involved.
Yes, we met at Ueno Station, right?
Yeah. We met up at Ueno Station. I think we grabbed some form of meat and coffee.
And I lectured you over your videos.
these are real things that happened.
Yeah, no, it was cool. And since then, we've met up quite a bit. I've joined you on a road trip last year. You did around Tohoku. You came on Journey Across Japan more recently, which is still ongoing. The last episode out this week, of course. But how did you find your time on Journey Across Japan as the cameraman?
It was when we originally looked at the schedule, the potential amount of time we had, I was like, you know, any of these shoots tend to be really busy.
Mm.
And I sat back and was very intrigued to see how it would play out. And as I expected, it was busy. It was busy, but it was also incredibly fun. I feel like these are all just really basic buzzwords. It was busy. It was fun. Mm. But it was an incredibly memorable time with a lot of good experiences.
So for those of you that watched the series, Norm was the guy behind the camera. And a lot of people asked, on the fourth episode with the capsule hotel, people asked, did you actually stay in the capsule hotel? People said, did the cameraman and did Ian as well? Did you get to stay in the capsule hotel?
Oh yeah, we were sleeping in the car. Isn't that the official
10
line?
Capsules, Joey and I. No, you got in there. You enjoyed it, right?
Yeah, it was a good time. It was a good time. I think my favorite part of the entire thing was that the actual story arc of the, I guess it'll be a spoiler for anybody who's not caught up, but the Mount Fuji story arc.
Oh, yeah.
Was very real.
Like, it was real, yeah.
We didn't think that we're sitting there every single day going, this it's just not going to show up. Like, it was predicted rain for the entire week. The anxiety.
It was a nightmare. But, yeah, we did pack a lot into that week, I must say. And it was a lot of fun. But we'll get into more of that in a bit. We do kick things off with Story of the Week here on the Abroad Japan podcast. And this week we've got one from Kim from the Netherlands. And it actually kind of ties in to our experience on Journey Across Japan. And it starts, hey, Chris and Pete, I'm a long-time listener of the podcast, watcher of the YouTube channel. Keep up the good work. I was pleasantly surprised to see Yudanaka Hot Springs featured in Journey Across Japan in the first and second episode. I visited the spa town with my boyfriend back in April 2018. It was a very memorable visit. It's quite a long story. I do apologize, but here it goes. On one morning, the owner of the traditional Japanese inn, the ryokan where we stayed, dropped us off on a road leading to the Snow Monkey Park. We hiked up there, and just as in your video, Chris, when we entered the park, there wasn't a monkey to be seen. God damn it, they're never there when you want them. The people from the park came out to apologise over and over and told us that someone would go up into the mountains to find the monkeys. We were very surprised that this was an option at all and laughed a little bit about it. As if it was just something they said to be friendly. But then a couple of minutes later, we saw a guy climbing up the mountain with a bucket full of apples, and they were actually going to get the monkeys. It must have been 20 minutes before he came back down again, surrounded by 150 monkeys, including lots of females with their newborns. We ended up having a great morning. Kim from the Netherlands. Why didn't that happen for us?
We had one monkey.
We had one monkey.
Yes. What?
Natsuki moping by the hot spring. What? That's not fair.
It's just, it's not fair for us.
I'm gutted.
It's heartbreaking.
But lucky you, Kim. I'm glad, I'm glad the staff made the effort for you.
I will jump in right here and say that the heartbreak just did not come through on the video. The moment in your face when you realize that there genuinely were no monkeys and that they weren't going to be showing up.
I mean, I don't think I would have minded as much if there wasn't, like, rain and just crap weather the whole time.
Yeah, it was quite a climb to get there, too.
I trashed my only decent pair of shoes going up through the mud. Like, you got these, like, the one good thing I own are shoes, and they're ruined now because of that climb. But it was worth it to see nothing. No, it was a shame. It was quite a funny opening, though, to be fair. I think we kind of turned it to our advantage by exploiting the comedic value of seeing nothing. And Natsuki's reaction was pretty good too. But go back and watch the misery of day two, Journey Across Japan. Yudanaka was nice though, wasn't it?
It was. It was a beautiful place.
For the 10 minutes we were there.
Not the most driver-friendly town.
No. If you're going there in a car, don't. Just don't, to be honest. But now we turn our attention to you, Norm. So the inevitable question that you've got to ask everyone who ever comes to Japan and lives here or does anything in Japan. What led you to come to Japan?
You know, they say when you access a memory, each time you access a memory, you kind of change it. And I feel like being in Japan as long as I have or we have, this question becomes exactly the manifestation of that. I don't remember what my first answer was. I don't remember what my answer was 5 years ago. But I do remember the thing that drew me back to Japan was I lived in Japan once, and it was about a year. At the end of the year, I went back to Canada. I did the working holiday thing. It was a good time. And a friend gave me a Yoshida Brothers CD. It was the first time I ever heard shamisen.
For those of the listeners that don't know the Yoshida Brothers, how would you describe them?
So the shamisen itself is like a three-string Japanese instrument. Mm. This one is very, the tsugaru shamisen, the one I play, is really high energy. It's kind of a mix between a string instrument and a taiko. It's got a really like,
it's got a really iconic kind of sound to it.
Yeah. And the Yoshida brothers are the players in that space. I think most people would know them first and foremost from the original Nintendo Wii commercial, where one of their songs was used. And then a lot of people who watch something like Naruto would know them as the people who did the shamisen music for most of the series.
Mm.
They played with Monkey Magic and
Blazer's band. Yeah, they did a really good, really cool collab. What's their biggest song? Is it Rise?
Rising is one.
Rising.
Kodo is another. Storm.
I have a weird relationship with them because I used their song, I think Rising, in the first Mount Fuji video I made in 2013, and that video got blocked by, I think it was Sony or Warner Brothers, and that's really sad because it was the number one Mount Fuji video. Yeah. It's not their fault, though. I did use their song improperly. If you've got a YouTube channel, ladies and gentlemen, don't steal. Don't use copyright music because you will live to regret it.
Mm.
But Norm has failed consistently to put in a good word for me.
I've tried. Side story here, they can't even get their own music unblocked on their YouTube channel that easily.
Yeah, and I found that with artists. When I met with Hyde from Larkinciel, I think he had the same sort of issues. Like, the artists often don't have much control of the music. It's the label, right? So
they
it's not
recently
their fault.
Put up a video that I made for them on their channel, and the process of getting their own music on their own channel unblocked.
Oh my God.
Anyway, so I heard their songs for the first time and thought, I've got to come back to Japan. I absolutely have to. And I came back and actually didn't do anything with shamisen. I bought a race car.
I didn't know that.
And spent maybe the better part of a year in that circle of things. It didn't end well, and decided I needed a safer hobby. A friend said to me, like, if you could do anything with your life, what would it be? And I said, well, I would be the apprentice of the Yoshida Brothers. I had actually listened to them play live in the States right before coming back, and very audaciously went up to them and I was like, I will meet you again in Japan. And
good
they
God.
Just they like chuckled and
yeah.
Like, yeah, good luck with that.
All right then.
And so I began the journey of trying to get an introduction to them. It took about a year. I got the introduction. I pleaded my case. I got rejected.
Waited
a couple months. Pleaded again. Got rejected. Waited about half a year. Pleaded again and told them that I would dedicate everything to it, that I wouldn't give up, that I would take it super seriously, and that if they said no, I would keep gently requesting until the day I died.
He's a persistent man, is Norm.
And I didn't get any contact back for like 6 months, when all of a sudden my phone went off one day and the older of the two Yoshida brothers was on the other end. He's like, I make you no promises whatsoever, but grab your shamisen and come to my place for coffee.
Good God.
And since that day, the rest has been history. And basically everything I've done in Japan since then has been based around that.
How old were you when you first came to Japan? How old were you when you was sitting in the Yoshida brothers' house with a shamisen?
I'd say 2005, I first came to Japan. I was like 21 or something like that. And it wasn't until maybe 2010, 2011, somewhere around there, 2010 or 2011, that I was sitting with a cup of coffee and a shamisen in front of the older of the two Yoshida brothers.
What an incredible journey and just persistency. It's the key, right? Persistency. You often, when you meet entrepreneurs or successful people, that is like one of the key traits they've got. They just keep going. They won't give up, and it's paid off. Like you've been friends with them for over a decade now, right?
Yeah. I've shot documentary content for them. It was actually the year leading up to that. The person that I got introduced to, who finally introduced me to them. Actually, I wasn't just like, "Hey, introduce me." I actually spent a year visiting that person almost every month and building up a relationship to the point where I could finally maybe ask without throwing myself under the bus. So while it sounds like a very aggressive approach, it did take time, but it was definitely worth it.
In terms of foreigners living in Japan that play the shamisen, where are you on the league tables? Are you like one of the top foreign shamisen players in Japan, would you say?
I don't know that there are that many within Japan. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are. Every now and then I run into people at tournaments and whatnot. There are some great players out there. I've actually stopped doing tournaments, and maybe it's the same, maybe it's relatable in like a YouTube sense of things, but for me, I really want to enjoy shamisen. So while I've actually taken top spots at tournaments, and while the Yoshida brothers are very kind with their praise, I'm a lot less concerned with like where I stand in comparison to others, and much more with how much I enjoy it. The second shamisen becomes a stress to me is the second I feel like I'll start to detach from it.
Right.
They actually offered to produce me, like do a whole CD and everything.
Bloody hell.
Then we were a couple months into working on songs with that, and I just totally stopped enjoying it.
Mm.
The recording process and just it just became such. I was like, I'm doing this because it's a journey,
right? And when a hobby becomes a job, and they've got the pressure there, it really takes some of the fun out of it.
Exactly.
Have you found that? So let's turn to your YouTube channel now. Have you found that with YouTube at all? See, you've been doing YouTube 3 or 4 years, maybe longer, but this year your channel's really kind of taken off. You're now 150,000 subscribers, and you've had some viral success. And I don't watch a lot of Japan channels because I live in Japan, right? You find when you live in Japan, you don't need to watch many other channels in Japan. But I do watch Norm's videos, and I do watch Tokyo Lens because we have quite a shared love of photography, of filmmaking. We both do a lot of short form documentaries, and you've had some pretty good success in the last year in general. What are some of the best sort of videos that you've done? I mean, the first one, the most successful was the guy living in an abandoned school in Shikoku.
That's
pretty cool.
Actually, the this year's video, it kind of lined up with the whole shamisen being produced for a CD thing. I decided to go the exact opposite with YouTube. Stop being a job with it and start just focusing on making stuff I really liked and I could be proud of. And it just led me to chasing a rabbit hole of potential possibilities. And the gentleman in the school, I happened to just literally stumble across him.
So there was no plan.
You were just zero plan.
Filming in Shikoku, doing a road trip.
Heading to the village with the scarecrow dolls that the woman handmade all the...
Oh, we've talked about that on the podcast. There's a town in Shikoku where the population's going down, unfortunately.
It's and 27 people now.
And there was a woman there that's replaced the population with scarecrows, like you do.
Yeah.
It's a really good video. What's that video called for our listeners? I know Pete and I actually discussed it a few months ago when it came out, because we've talked about it for years.
Okay.
And I thought about going, but after I saw what you did, I felt like, Norm's nailed it. I don't need to go down there myself now. But I remember you told me that you didn't want to meet the woman because at the time there was the whole coronavirus thing, and you didn't want to wipe out the last 27 people.
We had the opportunity, but I managed to get a hold of her via telephone, and it's in there. I think the video is called "This Japanese Town Replaced Humans with Scarecrows."
Right, and that's got 200,000 views, and the abandoned Japanese school, 1.6 million. It's really impressive stuff. But let's go back to why did you start your YouTube channel?
Okay.
Why?
I'm going to close that story arc. So we're on our way to the scarecrows.
Oh, yeah.
I got a call from like a friend who was like, yo, I think there's an abandoned school near there. And we rocked up and just walked around. The guy runs a cafe and a hostel out of it. It was closed. He started talking. I loved his story. And I was like, can I point a camera at you and just let you continue your story? And he's like, yeah. We ended up becoming friends. He had us stay the night. It was a whole thing.
He's a really quiet character. This is a video called "This Man Lives in an Abandoned Japanese School." It went viral. And what was the name of the chap?
Yohei.
And Yohei. It kicks off with him like playing the drums. And there's a really cool montage of him like in this quiet, empty school playing the drums. It's really quite special. And the fact you found him by sheer good fortune is pretty cool as well.
Yeah.
Like some of the best documentaries that you've made seem to have happened by sheer good fortune and chance. But so you've been doing it 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Now. And stuff like this is a good representation of kind of why I started. I worked, you know, I did the salary man thing, put on a suit, went to an office, you know,
got on the train.
I started out as a teacher for a while and then went into like office management, which was a lot less fun. I was corporate manager, like managing other people. I didn't enjoy life. I'd gotten to a point where I didn't like where my life was. And I decided that I have this love for Japan and I want to be able to focus more on that. I want to be able to, A, create more happiness for myself and also just kind of share more of what I really love. And so in order to focus on the positives, focus on the things that I really love, which is Japan, cameras, shamisen, I was like, why don't I just start capturing it? Now, I had pushes from really good friends like Sharla, who you'd mentioned was on the podcast previously. Another good friend out in Canada named Taylor. And they were just like, you should just start capturing stuff.
How tough was it going from a full-time job as a salary man to being a full-time YouTuber? You're a full-time YouTuber now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a pretty big leap as somebody who's done that as well. Like, I did it in 2016. And that's pretty scary because until then, my YouTube channel, Born Japan, is funded by my teacher's salary. Okay. And then after that, it was funded by YouTube. But the money from YouTube wasn't really as much as I was earning as a teacher. And I had to take out a loan sort of fund that kind of year and get through it. But it was a tough time. Like, how's that been for you making that transition? And would you recommend it to listeners that are thinking about doing YouTube full time?
I had the added lucky benefit of having the shamisen world behind me.
Right.
So I think I did a year of my full-time job and creating videos every single week. And a lot of those videos were for shamisen players on like a different channel that I run called Shamisen in Tokyo. And a few of those went pretty big, got like 1 million views and stuff. And we started to get offers from overseas. We got like offers from Australia, Canada, the US, wow. Italy, all over the place. And it actually came to a point where I had to choose whether or not I was going to continue this full-time job and all the stability that came with it, or whether I was going to stop that and go full on into the shamisen side of things and YouTube side of things. It's a bit of a leap, right? You're jumping from one vine to the next. You got to fully let go. And I got lucky that first year we did 5-6 trips overseas. All were really well funded by the people we went to visit.
So you still had some sort of support there from the shamisen side of things.
And then up until the world flipped itself upside down, I didn't really have to worry all that much about YouTube. YouTube was something I did because I really enjoy it. I was doing monthly shamisen performances around Japan. And shamisen performances, they're well paid. And that really helped me fund the YouTube channel and the adventures and everything. And then when the world flipped upside down, nobody wants to gather in a performance hall. So that and all the overseas performances, I had like 4 or 5 overseas performances booked for this year, all kind of went down the drain. And I just leaned into the YouTube side of things.
And it seems to be going well.
That
sort of pressure, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. That's great to hear, though.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? Mine's pretty low after coming back from the craziness of WrestleMania, too many body slams and all that. And I'm pretty jealous of my co-host Chris, who seems to have been exploring Japan's most isolated hotel. He's definitely winning in the relaxation race, but I'm determined to catch up with him. It can be easy to get swept up in social gatherings and spread ourselves too thin, but with therapy, you can learn to prioritize your time and recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Japan today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Japan.
Join us for a very Clash of the Titles Christmas, because we're doing what every family does at this time of year. Arguing about which film is better. We've proof this pod is good for your elf, as Elf takes on Santa Claus the Movie.
With Santa Claus the Movie, for years, I couldn't walk past a slice of ham without reaching for it like a grubby
street urchin.
Yeah, swear to God.
We're doing that festive thing of overindulging in sweet stuff. It's The Holiday versus Love Actually.
I've never seen women apologise so much for being women as in The Holiday.
And yes, they are Christmas movies. We've got Die Hard versus Lethal Weapon.
I'm so bored of that question, so let's flip it. Is Christmas a Die Hard movie?
That's Clash of the Titles this December. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Clash of the Titles is a Stakhanov production.
Merry Christmas!
What are some of the videos you're most proud of, do you think, as a YouTube creator? And I like your short-form documentary, so you're very much like, on the one hand, you're a vlogger who kind of, you know, covers your life in Japan and Tokyo, but then you've also, in recent years, focused on hearing the stories of different people, right? There was the ramen episode in Kitakata. I like that one. What are some of the more documentaries that you're proud of?
Well, as you said, the vlog side of thing, kind of capturing the life, is where it all started. But it is the documentaries, because of the challenge that comes into it. You know how much work it takes into finding the story and conveying the story in a documentary.
Yeah.
It's not an easy task. And when you actually manage to somewhat pull it off, you'll always look back and say, I could have changed this. I could have done this better. But when you walk out of it with something that For example, I spent years saving up to have a new shamisen built.
Mm.
It was years of performances, all literally put into envelopes. And I finally had one built and was lucky enough to be able to document the process of it being built by a Japanese craftsman. And I think that was one of the first like documentary-esque videos I did. And that one, the ramen one, oh. As much as I enjoyed
you went,
it.
So you went to Kitakata, which is the town with the most ramen shops per capita in Japan. And I've been there, and it's a fantastic town. If you like ramen and you find yourself in Japan, when airplanes are a thing again, folks, get yourself to Kitakata in North Fukushima. Sort of west side, isn't it? The west, northwest Fukushima.
Yes, northwest.
And you went to the original ramen shop where it kind of kicked things off, Banai Shokudo, right?
Yep.
Which right. I didn't get in because the queue was like 2 or 3 hours long. And I was like, not going in, not queuing for that long. Was it worth the queue? Or did you get to avoid the queue?
I got to avoid the queue.
In lucky fact, devil.
Rocked up not even knowing if we'd be able to make a video. Hadn't heard back. And so decided to, this one was the Ministry of Foreign Affairs had been like, hey, go out there and make this. But we never heard back from whether or not we'd be, So rocked up to the shop at like 5:30 in the morning. And they were like, oh, we didn't get back. Yeah, sure. No problem. And then so had no plans. I just shot everything all day, nonstop. I think I got 2 terabytes of footage.
Bloody hell.
And And at the end of the day, sat down with the owner to do a little bit of like a one-to-one face-to-face interview. And at the end, he offered to make a bowl of ramen. Wow. And it all just kind of came together.
So you lucky devil. A bowl of ramen from the owner of one of the most famous ramen restaurants in the whole of Japan, I guess. Yeah. But is it easy going into these places and filming generally? Like a lot of listeners and viewers often ask me, how is it, you know? Filming inside places in Japan, but
I think it's going to have a lot to do with like your personality as well. Like as somebody who did a lot of street photography, I'm a little more comfortable with pointing a camera towards a person, and you can read the atmosphere.
And you speak Japanese fluently, so you can kind of get around it, I guess.
So, and like you know, if they don't want you to, like that'll be right. Also, sometimes you'll have people be like, "Hey, I think you were just shooting. Can you not include me in that?"
Right.
And then you're like, "I just put a black frame there, so I know not to put the one before it."
Yeah.
But for the most part, you also get used to shooting the back of people's heads or shooting over people's shoulders when they're eating. You develop techniques that make it a lot easier the more you do it. When you start, you're like hands kind of shaking. You're a little bit nervous. You're like, am I going to get in trouble for shooting in here? Like, are people going to get upset at me? Are they going to be bothered by the camera? And as with anything else, the more you do it, the more comfort you build.
I mean, looking at the kind of the foreigner YouTube space in Japan at the moment, what do you think the atmosphere is? Do you think there's still room for more creators? Would you encourage people to do it?
Always room for more creators.
I've noticed that it hasn't really, the number of kind of foreign vloggers in Japan hasn't grown that much over the years. I wonder why that is. I think it's because it does take years to kind of build up a strong enough following to be able to do it full time and then to sort of grow it, right?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the hardest thing to do is persevere. Persevere through the times where it's not going well. Persevere through the times where you're not, like, for the longest time, I was just making videos because I wanted to make videos. They weren't necessarily doing great. They weren't popping off anything, right? But I had the love to do it. So I was like, I don't care. I'll just continue. And I had that luxury. But I think if somebody's goal is to be full-time on YouTube and they start a channel with that in mind, the pressure is a lot harder.
I completely agree. Like I was lucky as well. Like I did it for 3 years before I actually got to do it full time. But in that 3 years, you know, I did it for fun. There was no sense of pressure. And I think that is a problem. And I'd say to anybody, you guys listening that are interested in doing YouTube, before you think about doing it full time, do it for a few years first and see if you enjoy it. And don't put pressure on yourself. Because if the people I meet who fail are the ones who are like, I need 100,000 subscribers in a year. And they're focused on that target rather than making videos that they get excited about or videos that people will actually kind of enjoy.
Yeah, and you've got to enjoy the process because you're going to have ups, you're going to have downs. If you can't enjoy the downs, if the downs drag you down every time, So I actually recently put out something where I was talking about how I made videos every single week for a year before I published anything to YouTube.
How did you do that?
I just wanted to, I told myself that if I was going to do YouTube, I needed to have the consistency. I needed to make sure that I actually liked making videos.
You were almost terrifyingly persistent.
I like to enjoy the process.
Don't make Norm angry. He will come for you. He won't stop. He's relentless.
But yeah, if you can do that, I think everybody wants to document their first trip to Japan, subsequent trips to Japan. So I think that I said something along the lines of like, if your grandparents had a podcast, like the one we're listening to right now, where they just documented like a Tuesday with Sally and George, like... You'd listen to that. You'd want to know what your grandparents' life was like back in the good times, the bad times, the boring times. What did they do on a Thursday evening?
Watch Abroad Japan, I hope.
Hey! So, yeah, I think that everybody, whether it's videos, photography, just podcasts, anything, I think everybody should, even if they don't create, because creating and documenting are a little more different, right? Even if they just like, today I did this. Just document what you're doing. I've got tapes from my first trip to Japan 15 years ago that I look back and I'm so glad that I have.
I've got a few somewhere. I mean, on my first year, I did film quite a lot of stuff, but can't bring myself to watch it. It's almost a bit too embarrassing, to be honest. So as somebody who has lived here for a decade, you speak Japanese to, I'm going to say, a native speaker level. Your Japanese is very, very good. How did you get that good?
What's
the secret?
I'm going to do the Japanese thing and say, I wouldn't say it's quite that good. I'm comfortable with Japanese more than anything. I had a friend back in Canada from China who could barely speak a word of English, but his confidence when not speaking English was incredible. He was a communicator above all else. And I try to bring that into my Japanese. I'm comfortable with the language.
Did you sit down and study textbook? You seem like somebody who would have just gone out and used Japanese and spoken.
Kind of, yeah.
A bit like Charlotte. Like Charlotte, somebody who speaks to almost a native speaker level, I'd say, and very, very good at Japanese. But she's like, I never used a textbook. I just went out and used it. And that's something I regret maybe not doing as much. I often use textbooks a lot more than I should, I think. It's quite scary going and talking to people. But you seem like somebody who doesn't have that fear when just going out.
Well,
talking to people.
My college university days, I befriended Japanese people. I basically spent 3 years almost living with them. And the rule was inside the house is Japanese only. And it started with really basic stuff like having a meal together and saying, this is an egg. This is rice, right?
So it's that kind of limitation, right? Of being like, you could only speak in Japanese. That's a good point. And actually the... most people I've met who are fluent, like to a native level in Japanese, do put that limitation on where they say, right, I'm not going to speak my kind of native English language. I'm going to speak only in Japanese and think only in Japanese. And that is something I guess I haven't done. And that held me back a bit. I've always felt I've struggled. So I've often revert back to English.
I've also had the luxury of very specialized hobbies. Like cars and drifting taught me an entirely new form of Japanese that I know. Learning shamisen was a totally like musical Japanese. I didn't know any of those words.
Musical Japanese.
Dipping my foot into these like specialized lingo, if you will, also kind of helped build comfort. There's still a lot of stuff I don't know a lot. But
so I guess just be proactive, go out, meet people. Do new things and use Japanese practically.
Yeah.
How much time did you actually spend with a textbook? And
I don't think I've ever
opened it. God damn it.
So in high school, at the end of high school, I had a teacher who was like, you should learn Japanese. And he was like, I'll tell you what, here's my little dictionary. If you learn hiragana within the month, I will give you this dictionary. It was his dictionary from his time living in Japan. And I sat in the hallway and I practiced hiragana during my lunch breaks and whatnot and wrote it out on the board one day. And he's like, keep the dictionary. But I think that's the closest thing. And like, I learned all the wrong words, by the way. Like half the stuff that I learned from that dictionary are words that Japanese people don't actually say.
Right.
So when I tried to use them, they'd look at me like, what? So that kind of put me off of using books.
So what advice would you have to our listeners looking to study Japanese and become fluent?
Just listen and copy. Listen and copy, listen and copy. Build up that listening comfort.
And find somebody to actually talk to.
Absolutely.
And communicate. I guess that is the main problem, though. Especially in the UK. I think there's more Japanese people in Canada than there are in the UK, potentially.
Definitely. But it's also, like, we're recording this in 2020, where there's no shortage of apps or portals or platforms on which you can jump on, like, and try to communicate with somebody
who's iTalki, not, yeah. Hello Talk, and all those things. Yeah.
It's everything.
Good point. Good
Wish
point.
I had those things. I was MSN Messenger at best, talking to my Japanese friends' moms to practice my typing and reading in Japanese.
I remember MSN all too well. But we'll hear more from Norm's experiences living in Japan in Sunday's episode. And we've certainly got a lot of experiences there to draw from. But let's now turn our attention to the fax machine, where we read out your comments, questions and stories. And we got one from Giselle and Dee from Canada. You're from Canada, Toronto, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Toronto. What's Toronto like?
It's
still not being.
I don't really know how to, like, what's Toronto? It's
a place of magic and wonder, isn't it?
It's like a, I don't know. I want to say it's like New York, but it's not. I want to say it's like Montreal, but it's not.
I've been to Montreal and Vancouver. How's it compared to them?
Vancouver's a really pretty place. Mm. Toronto's just like your old city. It's like a Chicago, New York kind of, but with bacon. I don't know.
With bacon. You've sold it to me, Norm. You've sold it to me. Giselle and Dee from Canada. So, hi, Chris and Pete. My mum and I are planning a trip to Japan next November. While I'm comfortable using chopsticks, my mum has never learned. She's trying to learn, but is really struggling. She had a severe case of carpal tunnel syndrome in both hands about 10 years ago, which meant that there was some damage to her hands. My question to you is, would it be considered rude to request a fork at restaurants or to bring said utensil for her use? What would be the best way to ask or approach the issue with restaurant staff? We loved the YouTube video you did on Don Quixote, and we plan to purchase some sappy underwear for my brother as a Christmas gag gift. That should be embarrassing come Christmas morning 2021. Merry Christmas from my family to you both, Giselle and Dee. Sappy underwear. Are you familiar with sappy underwear?
What is this sappy underwear?
So Don Quixote has a lot of bizarre brands of underwear. They've got Black Man underwear.
What?
It's called Black Man underwear, and it's like a thong for men, so it's a bit odd. And sappy, which are nice looking underwear, but they're just called sappy.
They're just called sappy.
Yeah, imagine like going on a date with a girl, trousers, underwear, pants come down if the date goes well or whatever, and then I just see sappy underwear. Sappy. How would that go? I don't remember which video that is, actually. It's either one about crazy Japanese English, or I did a specific video on Don Quixote about 3 or 4 years ago at Christmas time, but the ultimate gift there. Interesting question. What about, what do you think about that? Utensils.
So I think we're both friends with Dogen.
Yes, and Dogen, great YouTube channel and Twitter guy.
And him and I had a talk a while back about how it's actually, people live in this world where they're very afraid of offending Japanese people. They're very afraid that what they're going to do is
even I was. Rude. I mean, I was as well before I came here.
Can you remember the last time that you've actually offended a Japanese person, though?
I actually can't. No, it's. I don't think I've ever made anyone angry. Like, and that's a really good point, actually. Like, I did that video, What Not to Do in Japan, which lots of people seem to have reacted to in recent months. But it's very hard to cause offense. Actually, no, the one time I did see someone get angry, it wasn't me, it was my friend George. We went into a bathhouse in Kyoto, and he accidentally walked in with his shoes on. And that is the one thing that will trigger a response, I'd say. Having your shoes on. So that's the one thing you need to worry about, genuinely. But no, asking for utensils isn't going to make anyone angry. Sometimes they do say to you, do say, like, do you want knife and fork? And so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Maybe do bring a fork, though, because a lot of places don't have utensils, right?
Yeah. I think they, so there's that like Japanese concept of kiyotsukau, right? Mm. Where they worry about the people around them.
Yeah.
And I think if you're really worried about keeping their comfort, I think they'd be a lot more comfortable with you using a fork and enjoying the meal. Then I think they'd feel bad about watching you struggle with chopsticks and not be able to enjoy the meal properly. That would make them be like, oh no, we gotta, you know, maybe we should offer them a fork. And by that point, it's too late, right?
I mean, that is one of the most common questions you do get in Japan. Are you, can you use chopsticks?
Yeah. So,
this could be one of those occasions where you can say no, because my mum has an actual problem with her hands. So, yeah, don't worry about it, but maybe do bring some utensils and get around that. But I hope you have a great time in Japan when you do come, Giselle and Dee. And, yeah, good luck with the sappy underwear. I'm sure your brother will love it. I got one from Chris Alston.
Yeah, I'm going to read this one out then. I have tried numerous times to study the Japanese language on my own. Every time, without fail, I would follow my app or book for about a week or two and then just get distracted by life and put things aside. Thus, I recently decided to enroll in an actual course taught by a native speaker provided by my local community college. Given the state of the world, the course would be entirely virtual, but I'm excited to have something to focus my efforts on and to hold me accountable in studying. I know you've answered many questions about learning the language before, but I was wondering if you had any specific advice for learning for language learning in a virtual setting. All the best, Chris Alston.
I mean, yeah, we touched on that a minute ago. I would say I was impressed with iTalki, which are that the service where you can like just talk to someone on kind of Skype, I think, and just chat with them. And that worked really well. I was sponsored by them like 4 or 5 years ago, and I used them before that. And when I did use them for a time, I found them to be very good. I had a really nice woman. I can't remember what her name was, but she was really lovely and down to earth. So if you find a good teacher, then it does work. Mm. Like, don't think it's an issue. What do you think?
Do you know Jerry Seinfeld?
I do. Yeah,
the comedian.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jerry Seinfeld had an approach to becoming a comedian. And what he would do is his goal was just make one joke every day. Just write a new joke every day. It doesn't have to be good. Mm. It just has to be every day. And he'd mark it off on the calendar. And the goal was to create a chain and to never break the chain.
Oh, the chain, right.
And I think that's a great method to learning a language as well. You don't have to study for an hour that day. You don't have to study for 20 minutes that day. 5 minutes is enough to say you've done it. The hardest part is always starting.
Yeah.
You can start, you can go for 5 or 10 minutes, but it's been on your mind that day. And just don't break that chain a little bit every single day.
That's a really good point. I remember a few years ago when I was doing this like weight loss challenge with mixed results. I did all right. I did lose about 5 or 6 kilograms. 7 kilograms I lost. But I told myself I would work out and do exercise for 20 minutes every day, which doesn't sound like a lot, right? But what I found is, for me, 20 minutes felt like an inconsequential amount of time. So I thought, I can fit that in. I'd start doing it. I'd go, wow, I'm really enjoying this. And then I wouldn't stop. And I would often work out for an hour. And so I would apply that method to anything, particularly learning something like Japanese. And I do think, you know, learning Japanese is really fun once you get into it.
It is.
The hardest thing can be that point in the day when you have to open a textbook and dive into it. But I love studying it. And I hope I hope it goes well, Chris. But
stick with it.
Keep us posted. Let us know how you get on. I'm keen to find out. We've got one from Georgie. He says, hi, Chris P. I used to work for Casio and an HQ designer. 30 years old, very shy, was visiting the UK and showing us other products he was currently working on. One of these products was a camera called Jizai, pronounced Jizai. God. Oh, dear. All the English speakers in the group went quiet, and our events manager asked, really? And took him aside to explain that why the name Jizai might raise some eyebrows. God's sake. The designer went cartoonishly red. However, it was too late in the production cycle to change the name, so whenever I visit Japan or Asia, I visit a camera store, see the Jizai, and smile at the memories of that day from Georgie. Oh, dear. If it's... crack out the Jizai watch with the sappy underwear. Job well done. That's awkward. Wow. I'd love to have seen the designer's face. He's flown all the way to UK to pitch his brand new, amazing Casio watch. I looked up the Jizai. It's like a gigantic, crazy sports watch. It has like a camera on it or something. Wow. I don't know who it's for. It looks very elaborate. What are your thoughts on the Jizai?
I'm just trying to catch my breath. It was excellent. So hard not to crack up as you were reading that. I don't even know where to start on that one.
All I know is I know what I want for Christmas now. Get me a Jizai. So I'm going to get one for Pete. I know he'll appreciate that. Keep the stories, questions, and comments coming into boringjapanpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back on Sunday to do it all over again with Norm. In the meantime, go and check out Tokyo Lens on YouTube or Twitter. You're everywhere, right?
Pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. Type in Tokyo Lens and tap your feet together three times and he will appear somewhere. But check out his fantastic documentaries, particularly The Abandoned School and The Scarecrows. That's my personal favourite. But for now, guys, we'll be back on Sunday. We'll see you then. Have a good one.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.